The New Testament reading comes to us today from the Gospel according to Matthew, chapter 2, verses 1 through 12. Listen closely for the word of the Lord. In the time of King Herod, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea, wise men from the east came to Jerusalem asking, "Where is the child who has been born King of the Jews? For we have observed his star at its rising and have come to pay him homage." When King Herod heard this, he was frightened, and all Jerusalem with him. Calling together all of the chief priests and scribes of the people, he inquired of them where the Messiah was to be born. They told him, "In Bethlehem of Judea, for so it has been written by the prophet, 'And you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah, for from you shall come a ruler who is to shepherd my people Israel.'" And then Herod secretly called for the wise men and learned from them the exact time when the star had appeared. And then he sent them to Bethlehem, saying, "Go and search diligently for the child, and when you have found him, bring me word, so that I may also go and pay him homage." And when they had heard the king, they set out, and there ahead of them went the star that they had seen at its rising, until it stopped over the place where the child was. And when they saw that the star had stopped, they were overwhelmed with joy. And on entering the house, they saw the child with Mary, his mother, and they knelt down and paid him homage. And then, opening their treasure chests, they offered him gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And having been warned in a dream not to return to Herod, they left for their own country by another road. Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church. Well, I was happy to notice the other day that the Nativity alien has resumed his post over the corner of Howard and 28th Street in Remington. If you've ever been in Remington, you might know of the Nativity scene that I'm talking about. It is that familiar entourage of plug-in plastic figurines that pop up all over town this time of year, incandescent in the evening rush hour traffic. Mary and Joseph kneel frozen in adoration on the rooftop of a row house porch, surrounded by glowing plastic angels and shepherds and donkeys, and the baby Jesus shines back at them in heavenly peace. But in the rear of this nativity scene in Remington, there is a bright green alien, nearly 3 feet tall, watching over everything with a very wry, extraterrestrial expression on his face. He has all of the traditional Area 51 features, the big, fat, bulging eyes, the Grinch-like head. And I can't claim to know the intentions of the owners of that house or what they think that means. And my first reaction, besides laughing at it, was to think that it must be meant to be irreverent. Most of the decorations in Hamden and Remington are. But intentional or not, I've decided that the Nativity alien captures a truth about the birth of Jesus that is worth remembering, even celebrating, which is why this year, my third Christmas in Baltimore City, I was pleased to see the little green guy take his place around the manger. Every year, the wise ones shuffle into town from the east, making their pronouncements and offering their gifts. And it actually took me a minute to realize, as I began to prepare for this sermon, that I preached exactly these two texts 1 year ago, January 4, 2015. And for a guy like me who really only preaches about 12 times a year, that kind of redundancy can feel a little disappointing. With so many amazing stories in the book, we are back once again with the wise guys. So I pulled up last year's sermons on Matthew 2, mostly to avoid repeating myself. And what became immediately clear to me is that while the scriptures are the same, our context has changed so much. And that makes all the difference in the world. One of my preaching professors in seminary was named Charles Bartow, and he liked to talk about what he called the preaching moment. While one can talk about a sermon as a written document or a speech delivered, the preaching moment is a theological idea. Because a sermon, see, can be written on a computer and stored away, but that preaching moment is a dance between at least four parties. There is the biblical text, which offers ancient insights. The preacher brings her thoughts and preparations. The congregation gathers and opens their minds and hearts, and finally and essentially, the Holy Spirit It moves in and among everyone, triggering thoughts and feelings and making meaning. So this collision of preacher, text, congregation, and spirit located in a particular time and place, all of that constitutes the preaching moment. It is bigger than any particular party and more than the sum of its parts. And also, while the text and even a sermon exist in time and can recur again and again, the preaching moment occurs only and exactly once. It is unique. And it feels appropriate to me to bring that kind of lens to today's worship service, in which we celebrate the festival day of Epiphany. The word Epiphany literally means light and can refer to an unexpected and abrupt realization. Today's reading contains both light and revelation, an unexpected encounter with the Christ child under a brilliant and rising star. It is a text like the wise men that we encounter year after year, but what might be that unique thing, that epiphany, which comes to us today? First things first, though, the text. Did you know that the wise men appear only in Matthew's gospel and only in the passage that we read for today? And while it is a very familiar text because of pageants and nativities, you'll notice right away what is not here. There is no indication that there were three of them, for starters. Their entourage could have been much bigger. The tradition of the three wise men originates from the three gifts they were said to offer Jesus, the gold and frankincense and myrrh. And secondly, there is no indication that they were kings. The Greek word that Matthew uses to describe them, magus, is most accurately described or translated as magi. And a magi, according to most secular sources, is a Zoroastrian or pagan priest. A magi of Persia, or the magi of Persia, were known for their astrological knowledge, their wisdom, or, as the English cognate suggests, their magical powers. But by the time the King James translation of the Bible was created in 1604, there was considerable anxiety about locating these pagan magicians in the birth story of Jesus Christ. Hence the translation wise men and the rapidly accepted idea that they were kings instead of priests or sorcerers. Martin Luther himself, the father of our Reformation, went to great lengths to distance the magi from the occult. They were rather, he insisted, just scientists of the natural world who would never dabble in anything so devious as sorcery. Well, that's all well and good, Martin Luther, but there's no getting around the notion that pagan astrologers from another country followed the stars to Jesus. And they found him faster than kings and Pharisees and scribes and almost all other religious people. Now, what are we to make of that? There is a lovely, kid-friendly sermon to be offered here, of course, about the virtues of gift-giving. The wise men faithfully delivered their gifts to Jesus, prompting us to ask what we too might give to God. There is nothing wrong with that sermon. But it is interesting to see how quickly the more subversive elements of the narrative were hardened into Christmas carol fodder. Because it is easier, after all, to fawn over a child fumbling down the aisle in an oversized crown than to ask why there were aliens in the nativity. When I mull all this over and ask what is happening in this present preaching moment, I can't help but be amazed at how relevant the alien became in 2015. And I'm not talking about Star Wars. I'm talking about that deep-seated fear of the other, the different ones who are coming among us to change our way of life. And I'm sure we could all cite out together the laundry list of people groups that are painted as alien and different and dangerous. None of that is new. But what feels new, at least in my lifetime, is the way that this fear-mongering is moving from the political fringes of our culture into the mainstream. The talking points that your racist uncle likes to spout out at Christmas dinner are now the policy positions of leading presidential candidates. And there is no immigrant or terrorist that we cannot thwart with bigger guns and higher walls, thinking goes. Gated communities and vigilant neighbors will keep young black men from invading our homes. Homeland Security will keep Muslims from entering our airports. Municipal laws will keep transgender men and women from entering our restrooms. Guns will be defeated by bigger guns, and terrorists will be defeated by even greater campaigns of carpet bombing terror. No one ever seems to notice that these walls also box us in, lock us up, render us prisoners of our own never-ending fear. Nothing is ever lost, they say, by closing the windows and barricading the doors. We have everything we've ever needed right here in our own narcissistic culture. But do the proponents of these positions denounce their Christian faith? Do they shake with fear like King Herod, knowing the prophetic witness of Jesus Christ? In fact, they do the opposite. They baptize their hatred in Christian rhetoric. They adopt a tone of righteous indignation when talking about preserving our God-given American way of life. In fact, much of what constitutes American civic religion is actually a bastardized form of Christianity tailored nearly exclusively to our own national interests. And the rhetoric demonizing any and every stranger really makes me angry. So I am grateful, very grateful even, for the wise men. You know, if Starbucks really wanted to start a war on Christmas, they should have put a magi on their red holiday cup. Pagan foreigners indoctrinating the Christ child with their strange ways. Once again, they are hiding right in plain sight, buried under sentiment and sugar cookies. The alien in our midst, kneeling right near the baby Jesus, teaching us the meaning of gifts and the power of hospitality. The arrival of the Magi and their swift deduction of the child's location, their decision to bow down in worship, all of these things signify a sea change in the power structures of Israel and the cult of the temple at the center of religious life. Walter Brueggemann explains how more than any other gospel, Matthew bathes his narrative in references to the Hebrew scriptures, linking the life of Jesus to the centuries of Judaism that preceded him. By choosing the gifts of gold and frankincense and myrrh and heading to Jerusalem, the Magi are invoking Isaiah 60, the passage that Adam just read. It's a prophecy that predicts the restoration of Israel after centuries of chaos. Isaiah predicts the restoration of Jerusalem in glowing and worldly terms, describing a thriving business economy and an influx of money and power. Such a passage was very appealing to kings and Pharisees who were invested in maintaining the status quo. So you can imagine their disappointment when the biblical scholars in Herod's own court suggested that the Magi were following the wrong prophet. They quote a very different text, Micah chapter 5. Far from enshrining the religious elite, Micah foretells the arrival of a peasant Messiah from the dusty bumpkin town of Bethlehem, 9 miles south of Jerusalem. But you, O Bethlehem of Ephrath, who are one of the little clans of Judah, from you shall come forth for me, one who is to rule in Israel, whose origin is from old, from ancient days, for now he shall be great to the ends of the earth, and he shall be the one of peace. Our task, Brueggemann writes, is to let the vulnerability of Micah 5 disrupt the self-congratulations of Isaiah 60. Most of us are looking in the wrong place. We are off by at least 9 miles. So armed with this new information, the Magi adjust their trajectory by a mere 9 miles south, and they make the trek towards Bethlehem. When I look at that circuitous route that led the Magi to Jesus, I see Bartow's preaching moment being played out in narrative form. The wise one began with Scripture, taking their cues from Isaiah, opening their hearts to where God might be leading them. But who knows if they would have even spoken of God? They followed the stars, the guiding lights that had brought them thus far. And that was an earnest and noble search, but it was not enough to guide them to the manger. And the story continues with religious leaders, diligent in their study and preservation of the tradition. They knew the prophecies inside and out. They knew about Bethlehem. They were earnest and deeply religious, but it was not enough to guide them to the manger. It was in this weird collision between experience and tradition, insiders and outsiders, that the Magi caught a glimpse of the way. But even that would not have been enough. In the end, they still followed the Spirit, born among them and before them in the form of the star. Text and preacher and community and Spirit constitute the preaching moment, that space that is somehow more than the sum of its parts. Text and preacher and community and Spirit coalesced around a manger in a neglected corner of the Roman Empire, signaling a new hope. And I'm sure that doesn't even come close to describing how the Magi felt that night, kneeling humbly before the Savior of the world. What does it look like in our own present moment to participate in that holy dance, to open our hearts to the alien in our midst? It could look like a lot of things, but it might look something like the Arlington Presbyterian Church. They are our Presbyterian neighbors to the south, located right in the rapidly gentrifying Columbia Pike community. Their church has been in the neighborhood for more than 100 years, but nearly everything else around them has changed dramatically. Again and again, they heard the same reports from working-class residents, many of them immigrants, goes the story from the Washington Post. I work here, but I can't afford to live here anymore. And meanwhile, the congregation itself was struggling with their own vitality, their own sense of mission in the community. And so just this past month, after years of deliberation, they arrived at a dramatic choice. They would sell their property to a company that builds affordable housing units. Their beautiful stone building would be replaced with 173 affordable housing units marketed directly to lower-income senior citizens. And the new construction will integrate the stones of the existing church into its facade, and the congregation will continue to worship on site in a rented auditorium on the first floor of the building. Susan Etherington, an elder at the church, explained that the congregation had been acutely aware of the housing crisis in their community for years. So what had prompted them now towards this dramatic course of action? It was sitting down and listening to the stories of their neighbors in person, many of whom were on the edge of eviction. When the congregation heard those stories of hurting and heartbreak, she reported, there was head nodding and agreement. When you tell personal stories, they have a resonance. And this story has only begun to be told, of course, and while the emphasis at the moment is on the brave action of the church, I suspect that time will also tell the story of the way in which this struggling church receives new life from this critical moment, new energy, new purpose, new faces in the seats, the unexpected gifts of strangers in their midst. So when I drive past the Nativity Alien on Howard Street, I try and let it serve as a reminder. The only reason why we, the Gentiles, the foreigners, the ones who weren't there, the only reason why we know anything at all of Jesus is because we were welcomed in the door like unfamiliar aliens. And in that weird, uncomfortable collision of tradition and innovation and belief and experience, a light appeared which led to Jesus. A light which speaks of a hope for the world that is born not by ironing out our differences, by welcoming and acknowledging and exploring them. It's a familiar story, so familiar as to feel banal sometimes, but the little green man is there to remind me that when it comes to Jesus, something new is always happening. Something strange is always happening, asking us to be included, asking to be understood, asking to be welcome, like Jesus welcomes us. And you know, we make a serious mistake when we think of welcoming the stranger as some sort of good deed, like the next step towards our Christian merit badge. No. All too often, that strange place is the cutting edge of God's future, the very place where light enters the world, a rebuke of guns and walls and warmongers who shake in their boots, so angry and afraid at the same time. There is another way. As old as God's story, as new as this present moment. It's something we know by heart, and it's something that we've never seen before. It's a theological idea, but let's not use that to let ourselves off the hook, because it's also your neighbor, your coworker, the man on the corner. It's someone in this room. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word became flesh and moved into our neighborhood. It's happening right at this moment, Epiphany Day 2018. 16 in a manner that has never happened before and will never happen again. So how and when and from whom will you receive it?